Good morning. Today, the campaign's been long, so what, among the razzmatazz, the TV ads and the bumper stickers, has been memorable? In the world financial storm, Hungary has grabbed a lifeboat from the International Monetary Fund, though our correspondent there has been preoccupied by foxes. The French, meanwhile, are arguing about what goes into school history books. And in a week when appropriate language is all the rage, why the Flemings suffer from being superior linguists and the Ossetians obsess about place names. Fascinating to many, gruelling to some, and the most expensive for everyone, the American presidential election is almost over. The polls suggest Barack Obama's in the lead, but others would have it that John McCain's an old fighter who shouldn't be entirely written off. Justin Webb says the contest has left him wondering if any other political show could ever compete.
Three unforgettable moments. The first, with John McCain in a medium-sized hall somewhere in New Hampshire. He's standing close to me, and one of his military veteran buddies, wearing a cap with battle honours neatly stitched on the side, comes up to hug him. The two elderly men, both tired and bleary-eyed, both their bodies past their best, held each other for a moment with genuine, unaffected love. Love for who they are and for what they represent. Generations of Americans who've fought for what they believe is the most honourable nation on earth, a nation that is, at its heart, decent. They were its sword, and it wasn't easy. And because of that, the bond between McCain and the vets is intense. It defeats on every count the love of the college students for Obama or the working mums for Hillary Clinton. John McCain can look stiff and out of place when hugging his running mate. Wow, he seems to be saying, what's all this about? He can even seem a tad distant with his wife. But with the vets, he melts, and it is an affecting spectacle. It is, to use one of the buzzwords of the entire campaign, authentic. The second moment that will stay with me forever was the arrival of Hillary Clinton in the packed convention centre in Denver to make the formal declaration that her campaign was over and Barack Obama had her support. Dramatic is a weedy word. It was seismic. It was physical. She came in at the same level at which the slaves and animals would have burst into public sight in a Roman amphitheatre. There was no room for anyone to breathe. The noise was deafening. She had to be propelled to the microphone, not because she was unwilling, well, not openly, but because of the crush. Humanity, sweating people, vying for control, for sovereignty, for dominance. This was about power. It was about having it and losing it. And as she left the hall, he had it, and she had lost. The third moment was also in Denver, but was outside the hall as I wandered, lost, looking for the portable office we were calling home. Suddenly in front of me there's activity. Men in grey suits are talking into their sleeves. Huge, sleek cars are being revved. Motorbikes are getting into formation. It is not him. It is his family. As the SUVs pass, including several with the doors and back window open, men with large automatic weapons looking out with keen, hard glares, as they pass me, I catch just a glimpse of the children, of 10-year-old Malia and 7-year-old Sasha, peering out. I think their mother was sitting in the middle. This is the true revolution. They have, after all, been prominent black politicians for decades now, men and women afforded the full protection and respect that the nation can muster. But seeing little black children gathered up into the arms of the Secret Service, surrounded by people who would die rather than let them die, is to see something that must truly make the racists of America's past revolve in their graves. I don't think Barack Obama will win or lose because of his race, but if he does win, the real moment you will know that America has changed is not when he takes the oath of office, but when we see pictures of tiny people padding along the White House corridors, a black first family representing America and American-ness. True, Americans tire of their presidents, but in the early years they hold huge sway. They set the style. Americans will look in the mirror, metaphorically speaking, and black faces will look back. I wonder if the Obama children have ever asked the question, are we nearly there? The answer at last is yes, we are nearly there. It has been quite a journey. And it's worth remembering, before being too sure about the result on Tuesday, that it has been quite a journey because of the bumps in the road that have thrown sturdy-looking vehicles off course, some ending wheels up in the ditch. So although most worldly-wise Republicans expect to lose and most Democrats expect to win, both sides will be short of breath over the next few hours as they hand the thing over to the millions of voters who still, as of this moment, have made no final irrevocable decision. At dinner with some mover and shaker Democrats the other day, one anguished guest turned to the others and cried, "Can't it just be over?" The tension, as the votes are counted, will be felt the world over. In spite of all the loose talk of the decline of American influence, this is, once again, the greatest political show on earth.
Justin Webb in Washington. This week, Hungary became the first EU country to receive financial support from the International Monetary Fund in response to the global financial crisis, with a bailout of £16 billion. As the financial storm clouds were gathering, our man Nick Thorpe took to the hills, but even there he didn't feel safe.
It was the week capitalism as we know it wandered over to the abyss and peered in. But I had other things on my mind. Foxes. The children were on half-term holiday and we had retreated to our cottage in western Hungary. As darkness fell, there were loud crunching noises in the garden. A large shadowy creature with a triangular face and a white tip to his bushy tail was prowling under the walnut tree, sometimes pausing to crack a walnut between his teeth. Soon he was joined by another. "Children, come quickly." We ventured outside. We'd never had foxes in the garden before. Now they were playing with an old football. They took a passing interest in us and in the neighbour's ginger cat, who passed within a whisker's breadth, then got back to the serious business of chewing walnuts. We offered bread and milk instead. They seemed grateful. After midnight, the phone rang. The IMF had reached a broad agreement with Hungary on a very substantial loan. The children were long asleep, but the foxes were still there, playing in our garden. I kept half an eye on them as I rigged a satellite dish up under the thatch and started trying to make head or tail of Hungary's role in the collapse of capitalism. To be frank, the collapse of communism was easier to understand. The next day we talked to friends about the foxes. "Keep away from them," said my sister-in-law. "They may have rabies." We googled them on the internet. Foxes and rabies. Strange behaviour. A tendency to eat inedible objects. Oh no. Had I exposed my loved ones to one of the most dangerous diseases left in the Western world? Means of transmission? Saliva. Well, none of us had actually gone over and stroked them, but still. They'd picked up and chewed everyday items the children play with all the time. Between reports detailing the government's response to the crisis and the opposition's criticism, I removed fox turds from the garden. Stacked hefty beech logs under the flimsy fence reinforced our defences. Threw away the most chewed footballs. Chopped wood to feed the hungry stoves, the only source of heating in the house in winter. A radio programme wanted interviews with people in Hungary already affected by the crisis. I drove down to Badacsony, our Table Mountain, overlooking the placid waters of Lake Balaton. Huber Seremle welcomed me in his summer residence with a glass of something cloudy, this year's new wine, just a month since the grapes were picked. The juice continued fizzing and fermenting in the glass. Huber is one of the grand old men of Hungarian wines. His family won back its estates when the communist system collapsed. As we sipped his grape juice, he told me a story about a monster who swallows all the villagers one by one. But then he swallowed a shepherd who had a knife open in his pocket, and the knife punctured the monster, who exploded, and all the people escaped. "The only question is," said Huber Seremle through a bushy beard, referring to the current financial crisis, "who has the open knife in their pocket?" "The economies of the world are in running shoes," Huber concluded our interview, "while the Hungarians are still stumbling around in heavy army boots." Giant bottles of the grape juice wine were brought out as a gift for the stray reporter. "Which ones can the children drink?" I asked him. "Maybe keep the six-year-old off this one." 2 nights later, the phone rang again, 1:30 in the morning. News just in from Washington. The rescue package had been finalised, $25 billion. But did Hungary really need it? A glass of sweet red grape juice by the phone, I dragged sleepy commentators out of bed. Was the Prime Minister hiding behind an IMF fig leaf, disguising his own policies as stringent IMF conditions? Or was this the only way to restore market confidence? And why did the world suddenly care about poor little Hungary? Does the domino effect really exist? If Hungary collapsed, would it pull down Austria too, and then Germany? And did our foxes really have rabies? Eva, a lady in the village whose opinion I respect above all others, reassured us that the foxes were healthy. They became tame, she said, because the neighbours fed them. We drank the bottles one by one. The red one had no effect. The others went straight to the head. Hungary weathered the storm. The forint recovered. The stock market soared. The fires slowly died in the grate. We could finally go back to bed.
Nick Thorpe, now back in Budapest. The French Minister for Education, Xavier Darcos, this week suggested, before an official committee, that Parliament should play a role in setting the curriculum for history in schools, and thereby provoked a major row. He touched a very raw nerve. As Hugh Schofield reflects, with its revolutionary background, France has never been able to agree on an official version of past events, and history remains a highly contentious and political issue.
One of my proudest recent acquisitions has been an original 7-volume History of France in bande dessinée, or comic strip format, first issued by Larousse in the 1970s and now regarded as something of a classic of the genre. In it we see 2 millennia sweep by, from Vercingetorix to Charles de Gaulle, in a succession of gloriously over-the-top illustrated tales. Never have flaxen-haired Gallic warriors looked more warrior-like. Never have pious medieval kings looked more pious. Joan of Arc is an attractive, nay sexy, gamine in an unlikely 70s bob. The revolutionaries of 1789 are fiery and indignant. Napoleon flashes with martial splendour, but comes face to face with destiny in the snows of the Russian steppe. The cartoons are splendid, full of movement and facial expression and just the right amount of gore. And the personalities are big and bold. All in all, on one level, an unsurpassed introduction to the main events of French history. Also, of course, on another level, a ludicrously superficial account of the last 2,000 years. This is, after all, not serious history. How could it be, when the characters are one-dimensional and the events that surround them reduced to a series of coloured images with speech bubbles? It is history as caricature. But maybe this is necessary. Maybe anything more probing or true to life risks becoming too controversial. Maybe in France, the wounds of the past are still not entirely healed. These thoughts occur because this week arguments over France's history have been back in the news. A special parliamentary committee has been sitting with the grand name of the Mission of Information on Memorial Issues. Its task has been to hear from experts and historians on the vexed question of what role the state and the legislature should play in determining how France's past is remembered. The very existence of such a committee says a lot about the sensitivity that surrounds these matters. It was set up after a series of occasions in which historians said that politicians were intruding provocatively into their domain. Back in 1990, there was a law passed that made contesting the Holocaust a criminal offence. That was perhaps not especially controversial, but historians say it created a precedent. There are now other so-called memorial laws. There's one officially recognising the Armenian genocide. There's another recognising the African slave trade as a crime against humanity. A couple of years ago, some right-wing MPs almost had a law passed that would have recognised the, quote, positive aspects of the colonial experience. It was eventually struck down after an enormous media hoo-ha. What all these events have in common, and what historians object to, is an evident desire on the part of public officials to set out an official version of the past. And this week, the Education Minister has gone further, stating before the committee that Parliament should help decide what history is taught in schools. More warnings of political interference, another huge row, and Monsieur Darcos has now been forced to back down. Why in France does all this, after all, somewhat abstract argumentation take on such importance? The answer, it seems to me, is that here in France there is no shared narrative. There are still two very much competing versions of what constitutes the country's modern history. The left-wing version remembers the ideals of the revolutionaries. It decries the tyrant Napoleon. It worships the 1871 Paris Commune and sees the last 200 years as a constant struggle between the forces of progress and reaction. The right-wing version deplores the guillotine and the excesses of the revolution. It recalls that throughout most of the 19th century, France continued to be ruled by kings and emperors. In more recent times, it believes that Charles de Gaulle, not the communist underground, was the true saviour in World War II. These two versions of history remain bitterly at odds, and any attempt to put an official imprimatur on one rather than the other is bound to cause almighty ructions. Far better to leave things vague and let historians do the arguing. Interestingly, I just noticed that Le Monde newspaper is offering readers the chance to buy a re-release of the LaRousse cartoon history. Its appeal is clearly enduring, largely, I suspect, because it doesn't dig too deep.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. From a dispute over history to one about language, Belgium has been at the heart of closer European integration for several decades, but remains divided itself along linguistic lines. Henri Astier, a Frenchman who works for the BBC, has been investigating the uneasy partnership between French speakers and their Dutch-speaking compatriots in Flanders.
I hadn't realized how much language mattered in Flanders until I visited Zaventem, a Brussels suburb that is home to the international airport. Despite, or perhaps because of, its cosmopolitan character, the town is intent on preserving its Flemish identity, and I wanted to talk to the mayor about this. When I told the receptionist at the town hall that I was there to see their boss, she replied in Dutch. I stared at her blankly. I tried my pidgin German, but got the same answer. In desperation, I used my native French, which I had kept as a last resort. The receptionist then showed me a sign saying, in 10 different languages, that Zaventem was located in Flanders and therefore officially Dutch-speaking. Communal staff were not allowed to address me in any other way. If I didn't speak Dutch, I was welcome to bring an interpreter. Finally, another woman behind the desk broke the awkward stalemate. BBC, she asked. I nodded hopefully. The mayor is expecting you, she said, and directed me to his office in perfect English. When I told the mayor about the incident, he saw nothing peculiar in it. Nowhere in the world, he pointed out, would anyone expect to just walk into a government office and be spoken to in the language of their choice. He's right, of course. But other countries, and indeed most Flemish towns, don't ban public employees from speaking another tongue if they want to. The fact that they do in Zaventem points to the complex relationship the Flemish have with language. On the one hand, of course, is protectiveness. Dutch, long suppressed by Belgium's elites and still scorned by many French speakers, is central to Flemish identity. This is especially true on the outskirts of Brussels. The capital is a largely French-speaking enclave within Flanders, and as its population expands outward, many Flemish suburbs are in danger of losing their native character. But Zaventem's linguistic edict is not just a sign of defensiveness. It also points in the other direction. Like their Dutch brethren, the Flemish are an amazingly open, polyglot people. In most places, there would be no need to forbid staff to speak foreign languages. This national trait, of course, is born of necessity. Dutch speakers have had to adapt to a world where few people understand them. Still, their linguistic skills can be astounding to a lazy French or English speaker. Like many other visitors, I experienced those skills in the cafes and shops of Bruges, Ghent and Antwerp. But Flemish willingness to adjust impressed me most during another meeting with a politician. My articles made the news in Flanders, another sign of openness, by the way. The BBC and other foreign media obviously have a big audience there. And as a result, the region's president expressed a wish to see me. I was taken aback. In my experience, it has always been me who tracks down public figures, not the other way around. When I got to see the minister president, I asked him why he'd wanted to see me. He said the Flemish did not always have a good press abroad, which is true, and it was important that I should have the correct information. Afterwards, there was a news conference with a group of Flemish journalists. I didn't think I would gain much from attending, but decided it would have been rude to leave. However, everyone naturally switched to English for the benefit of the one non-Dutch speaker in the room, myself. Somehow, I can't see the same happening in France, Britain, or anywhere else. Flemish linguistic awareness is a double-edged sword, a way of both reaching out to the rest of the world and keeping it at bay. Many outsiders, including foreign reporters, tend to focus on the defensive side, the bans, the language requirements for job applicants or benefit recipients in Flanders. These are seen as a sign of narrow-mindedness at best, a form of xenophobia that could lead to the breakup of Belgium at worst. Now, identity politics does exist in Flanders. In some towns, shopkeepers get pestered by local officials for not using Dutch enough. In one such area, I was surprised to find a bar where the menus were mostly in French. "How do you get away with it?" I asked the owner. He said his door was actually in the next commune, so he was safe from the Dutch-only brigade, although not necessarily from its most extreme elements. "Don't quote me," the owner said. "If I draw attention to my case, my window will get spray painted with nationalist graffiti." But such militancy is far from widespread. And above all, Flemish defensiveness is the flip side of something positive that foreign journalists rarely stress, a keen awareness of the virtue of multilingualism. Many Flemish people expect, somewhat unrealistically, French-speaking Belgians and foreigners to be as adaptable as they are. Zaventem's linguistically prickly mayor, after all, speaks near-perfect English and even better French.
Henri Astier, now back in London. In the summer, South Ossetia made the headlines as the Russian bear showed its claws and sent its military forces into Georgia in a brief and bloody dispute over the region's status. Borders and language always loom large in such arguments, and Tim Huell, who's just been there, says that Ossetians have long memories and a fascination bordering on obsession with the meaning of place names.
When the nights draw in the High Caucasus, when the flocks are gathered in the shadow of the ancient stone towers that dot the wooded hillsides, when there's no sound outside but the chattering of the fast streams that run down from Ossetia towards Georgia, there's nothing they like better than to settle down on the settee to watch an old DVD of Braveheart. Mel Gibson is very big in these remote parts, though not as big, of course, as the real-life hero he played in that film, William Wallace. So much do Ossetians love that 13th-century Scots patriot that one told me he made a pilgrimage to Edinburgh, only to find Wallace's statue disappointingly small and unimpressive. It's not hard to see why they identify with a ruthless fighter, romantically cruel, who defended his small mountainous homeland against a more powerful southern neighbour. For King Edward I of England, read President Mikhail Saakashvili of Georgia. He attempted back in August to regain control of the separatist-held territory of South Ossetia, but was beaten back by Russia, assisted by Ossetian volunteers who cast themselves as modern brave hearts. But the Ossetians aren't just like the medieval Scots. As far as they're concerned, they are the Scots, and the Scots are them. Centuries ago, possibly during the great migrations of the Dark Ages, some of their ancestors went down from the Caucasus and set sail through the Black Sea, the Mediterranean, the Atlantic, and arrived eventually in a landscape they recognised, Caledonia. In fact, though, they didn't just occupy Scotland. They occupied the whole of Western Europe on their fast horses, spreading the chivalrous respect for women that is originally an Ossetian concept. And how do we know they came here? Easy. Place names. Sitting over a pile of flat, greasy Ossetian cheese pies in a smoky cafe in Vladikavkaz, capital of Russian-ruled North Ossetia, and again later sampling a cup of young homemade wine in a war-damaged house in Tsrinvali, capital of the much-disputed South, I'm asked where I'm from. London. And what does the name mean? Of course, I don't know, but my hosts do. In Ossetian, London means standing water. Belfast, that in Ossetian could be broken spade. Orléans, in France, is stopping place, because the Ossetians stopped there. And our greatest national hero, King Arthur, was Ossetian too. His name means solar fire. Toponymy, the study of place names, has never been an overriding passion of the English. Indeed, the more you travel, the more you realise that one of the more unusual things about people in these islands is their comparative lack of interest in their national origins. Some children are taught about the arrival of the first Saxons or Frisians, Hengist and Horsa. Very few know the story of our legendary Trojan ancestor Corineus and his battle on the cliffs of Cornwall with the giant Gog Magog. Ossetian children know all about their forefathers' wanderings around Europe and how, eventually, their territory diminished again to those two little pockets on either side of the great Caucasian watershed, the southern one of which we heard so much about so briefly in August. But the Ossetians, in their glory days of continental mastery, weren't known by that name. They were sometimes Sarmatians and sometimes Alans. Every third Ossetian you meet now seems to be called Alan, and the North Ossetian Republic within Russia is officially Alania. As satisfying, I suppose, for Alans as it would be for me to live in Timia. Meanwhile, the Alans in the south now live, supposedly, in an independent state, a minuscule state of 50,000 people, recognised only by Russia, Nicaragua and Somalia. The rest of the world insists it's still part of Georgia, though the people I met there say that since the war they could never again live in one country with Georgians. What some dream of is a greater Ossetia, uniting north and south, a place where their ancient Iranian-linked language and swashbuckling culture can flourish free of Georgia or Russia. And if they achieve that, they may want to expand still further to their older, wider stamping grounds. Those of you living in Oxford, Newcastle, Redbridge, and anywhere else with an obvious derivation can sleep easy in the knowledge that you have a right to be there. But if you're listening to this in Bristol, Hove, Crewe, or another place whose name you can't instantly explain, I should start worrying. The Alans are very mobile, and they have long memories.
And with that timely warning from Tim Huell, we've reached the end of this edition. There'll be more from our own correspondents next Thursday and next Saturday, so please join us then. Goodbye.